Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have some important stories for you, starting with a strike by mental health care workers at Kaiser Hospital. Then on our Capitol Report, we'll be telling you about a bill to help prevent veteran suicides. On Green Scene, learn about a court ruling that will impact the Delta smelt and water in California. At the local level, we'll be telling you about plans to build a skate park in Ramona that are ramping up. And then on Tribal Beat, hear why a new memo issued by the U.S. Justice Department may open up the way for Native American tribes to grow marijuana to meet the growing demand for medical and recreational marijuana in states where it is legal. On Bookshelf, Raina Menashe will be interviewing Tim Daniels, a former ICE agent, about his new book, An Ongoing Investigation. We'll be replaying our newsmaker interview with Mr. Saladin, founder of the War Victims Group, about the latest situation and efforts to help refugees in Iraq. On our business report, hear about Hagen's Market that's coming to town, buying up some of the Vons and Albertsons stores around East County and San Diego. Learn why Petco has pulled pet treats made in China. Hear about a chance reunion between a dog missing for 8 years and his family in El Cajon. Learn about a measles outbreak in San Diego that is tied to exposures at Parkway Plaza and Disneyland over the holidays. And then if you're looking to get fit or trim up as part of your New Year's resolution, we'll be telling you about some programs and places that the county is offering to help you do just that. Stay tuned for these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
Mental health care workers are marching in protest outside of the Kaiser Permanente's Medical Center on Zion Avenue in San Diego this week, claiming Kaiser's rules are unfair to them and their patients. It's part of a statewide strike at 65 locations statewide, the largest walkout of mental health workers ever in the United States. Union officials claim they are understaffed and have had to delay their patients' visits, often taking up to 2 months for an appointment, a lag they believe puts health and lives at risk. A longtime therapist at Kaiser, Jim Clifford, says, "It's really unethical for us as healthcare professionals to be having to practice that way," KPBS reports. This isn't the first time Kaiser has faced such accusations. In 2013, Kaiser was fined over $4 million by the state for forcing mental health patients to wait unreasonable amount of time between appointments. Protesters claim that with lack of staff, this issue has not improved. The protest includes roughly 2,600 mental health workers statewide who are members of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. The union is currently attempting to renegotiate the terms of its contract with Kaiser. Roger Daugherty, a spokesperson for Kaiser, claims, "This has not impacted our mental health services for emergency and urgent care whatsoever." Daugherty also claims that the mental health care system is operating appropriately. He contends that appointments may be weeks out due to patients' preference or scheduling availability. Daugherty accused union members of raising the issue to try and get a better contract. He says, "In our estimation, it's a bargaining tool they're using," according to UT San Diego. Many protesters say they are genuinely concerned about the patient's well-being, however. They argue that it is important to schedule appointments close to each other so that the patients can make real progress. Robin Sales, another therapist at Kaiser, says she is concerned about delays in patient appointments. "We are really worried about people committing suicide," she says, UT San Diego reports. Both sides have indicated that negotiations between Kaiser and the union are continuing. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Hayden Parsley.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The House of Representatives has unanimously passed H.R. 203, the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act. This bipartisan legislation, originally passed by the House in the 113th Congress, but blocked by a single U.S. senator, addresses the epidemic of suicide among our nation's veterans. All five congressional members from San Diego County voted in support this week. Congresswoman Susan Davis issued this statement after the measure's passage. "Too many of our veterans are lost to suicide because the country they served and sacrificed for has not provided them with adequate support," said Davis. "This bipartisan legislation provides our heroes the care and support to help them overcome mental health challenges, traumatic brain injuries, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Everyone who served their country should feel that their nation stands behind them with compassion and dedication every day," she said. 22 veterans commit suicide every single day, more than 8,000 a year. Of the more than 2 million Americans who have served in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, it is estimated that one-third, roughly 600,000 women and men, have traumatic brain injury, PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress syndrome, or depression. Named in honor of late Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran Clay Hunt, a noted suicide prevention advocate who committed suicide himself in 2011, the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act will establish a peer support and community outreach pilot program to assist transitioning service members with accessing VA mental health care services. Also a one-stop interactive website to serve as a centralized source of information regarding all mental health services for veterans. A student loan repayment pilot program aimed at recruiting and retaining psychiatrists that will help address the shortage of mental health care professionals, and an annual third-party evaluation of all mental health care and suicide prevention practices and programs at the VA to find out what's working and what's not. The bill was introduced by Representative Tim Walz, a Democrat from Minnesota who is the highest-ranking enlisted soldier ever to serve in Congress, and co-authored by Chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, Jeff Miller, a Republican from Florida, along with Representative Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat from Illinois who is a triple amputee, Purple Heart recipient, Iraq War veteran, and a member of the Army National Guard.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The highest court in the land has sided with one of the tiniest fish in California by refusing to hear an appeal on Monday. The U.S. Supreme Court was asked by some California farming interests and water districts to consider overturning a case that affirms protections for the Delta smelt, a fish found only in the San Francisco Bay Delta. After years of pumping and diverting water from the Bay Delta, water users stepped in to challenge the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when it made some changes to keep the smelt from extinction. Gary Bobker with the Bay Institute says the steps were small but critical.
And what the courts have basically affirmed is that the steps the government took are scientifically justified. If it hadn't been for those steps, I think there's no doubt that after several years of extreme drought, on top of many years of bad water management, we wouldn't have any smelt at all.
The Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal in the case is also being touted as reinforcement of the importance of the Endangered Species Act for allowing the feds to give priority to the survival of a species over economic concerns. Attorney Trent Orr with Earth Justice, who represented the conservation groups in the case, notes that the Delta smelt used to be one of the most common fish in the Bay Delta, but current tallies indicate it's now one of the most rare. However, Orr says the case reaches beyond protecting a single fish species.
It was a very healthy population, and not coincidentally, the populations of a lot of other fish in the Delta have also dropped. So it's sort of an indicator for the health, or unfortunately the lack of ecological health, of the Delta.
With the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal, Orr says the case has gone as far as it can in the legal system, but he predicts it isn't the end of the survival challenges for the Delta smelt. For Public News Service, I'm Chris Thomas.
Efforts are ramping up to build a skate park in Ramona. Ramona Skate Park Champions is a new organization seeking nonprofit status. Its members include residents, parents, local businesses, and skateboarding enthusiasts. Their goal is to raise money for construction of a 16,500 square foot Ramona Skate Park on Main Street behind the Ramona Library. The site is on county-owned land that's part of the Ramona Intergenerational Community Campus. That means the park would be run by the county's Parks and Recreation Department, and the county would take on liability for the skate park once again. A public meeting on the proposed skate park will be held on Monday, January 19th at 6:30 p.m. at Ramona Town Hall at 729 Main Street in Ramona. The group aims to create a 5-year plan similar to the plan used to build Lakeside Skate Park, which opened last May, the first such facility in the county's unincorporated region. The project's supporters include the Tony Hawk Foundation, which has donated over $3.4 million to help build hundreds of skate parks nationwide. The foundation's founder, Tony Hawk, won the National Skateboard Association's World Championship 12 times in a row. The Ramona Skate Park Champions has set up a website at www.ramonaskatepark.org, as well as a Facebook page to organize and raise funds. Dwight Webster, media and outreach champion for Ramona Skate Park Champions, acknowledges that the effort will take time, the Ramona Sentinel reports. This will be a long race, he concludes, not a sprint. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
The Gillespie Field Development Council has 3 open seats, including 2 seats representing El Cajon and 1 from the county. At its last meeting, the council voted against a proposal to expand the board from the current 5 seats to 7 seats. But some people, including Citizens Against Gillespie Expansion or CAGE, want to see a council that includes representation from citizens in the community, not just a board that represents government entities and pilots' interests. CAGE spokesman Robert German says his group supports 7 seats for a more balanced council with knowledge on real estate, non-aviation businesses, security and environmental issues related to noise, air, and water. He notes that the airport is the biggest real estate holding entity in the El Cajon Valley, with 852 acres. German adds, security is obviously a concern, as Gillespie has 4 flight schools training employees from all over the world, mainly China and the Middle East. Other San Diego County airports, including Fallbrook and Palomar, already have advisory boards that include seats for citizens, so residents in East County want to know why the county won't expand the Gillespie Council to give citizens here a voice, too. But that would mean even more seats to fill, and there are already 3 vacancies. Terms for the 3 open positions on the council are 4 years. The council meets on the 3rd Wednesday of every other month, starting in January. If you would like to receive an application or have questions about these openings, you can contact the clerk for the Board of Supervisors at area code 619-531-5600. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with today's Tribal Beat. At the request of Native American tribes, the United States Department of Justice has issued a policy statement offering guidance to United States attorneys on priorities for enforcing marijuana laws on tribal lands. Given that many states have legalized marijuana for medical, agricultural, or recreational use, the statement lists 8 priorities for enforcement on tribal lands and makes clear that any enforcement must require consultation with tribal partners. The tribes have the sovereign right to set the code on their reservations, says Timothy Purdon, U.S. Attorney for North Dakota and chairman of the Attorney General's Subcommittee on Native American Issues, U.S. News reports. Many have interpreted the Justice Department's statement as giving a green light for tribes that wish to cash in on growing marijuana for lawful uses to do so, and some California tribes are moving forward to do just that. On December 12th, the Department of Justice issued a statement saying that it would not interfere with Native American tribes who choose to legalize marijuana for medical, agricultural, and recreational use on tribal lands. An article on Native Times, a publication for Native Americans, reports, the federal statement appears to allow tribes that wish to grow marijuana for legal purposes to engage in cultivation, providing they don't trigger one of the 8 enforcement guidelines. Those triggers include distributing marijuana to minors, fueling revenues to criminal enterprises such as cartels or gangs, diverting marijuana to states where use remains illegal, using marijuana activity as a cover for other illegal activities, using firearms in cultivation or distribution of marijuana, drugged driving, or growing marijuana on public lands. But the Justice Department's statement warns that nothing in the statement precludes investigation or prosecution, so some ambivalence remains. Still, some tribes are moving forward. The Pomo tribe in Mendocino County, California, is building a $10 million indoor marijuana growing facility near Ukiah And that's come as a surprise to county officials. They are believed to be the first California tribe to build a large-scale cannabis cultivation facility. But according to the Riverside Press Democrat, the same corporations that helped the Pomo tribe set up operations are now planning similar cultivation sites on tribal lands in southern and central California. State and local governments won't have much, if any, say-so about tribal marijuana cultivation in states where it's legal. Medical marijuana is legal in California, and in 2016, a ballot initiative is expected to ask voters whether or not to approve legalizing recreational use as well. Southern California is home to nearly 30 recognized Indian tribes, and there are 326 federally recognized tribes nationwide. While some market watchers had anticipated tobacco companies might have taken the lead in large-scale marijuana growing operations to fill demand in 23 states where some form of marijuana use is now legal, it now appears that Native American tribes will be first in the market. The marijuana cultivation industry, like casinos, could provide a lucrative source of income that could reduce the high rate of poverty that remains in many Indian nations, also providing jobs on the reservation. But not everyone is happy about the move. Some, such as Yakima Tribe in Washington State, remain opposed to marijuana cultivation, the Los Angeles Times reports. Kevin Sabat, former advisor on drug issues to President Obama, has called the policy extremely troubling. He now directs the Drug Policy Institute at the University of Florida. Sabat observes that Native Americans and their families suffer disproportionately from addiction compared to other groups, particularly with alcohol, Sabat says. The last thing they want is another commercialized industry that targets them for greater use. But Dale Gehringer, California State Coordinator of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Law, sees tribal efforts to meet legal marijuana demand as a sign of the times.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Timothy Daniels, retired supervisory special agent of U.S. Customs, or ICE, and author of the new novel, An Ongoing Investigation. My guest, who has a long history of working with narcotic smuggling cases and money laundering, he brings a unique perspective to a border city like San Diego. An Ongoing Investigation is the sequel to his debut novel, A Target-Rich Environment, which was published in 2011. Welcome, Tim. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
And thank you for having me, Raina.
Let's begin with An Ongoing Investigation. I know the story is about a task force trying to stem the flow of narcotics coming into the U.S. from Mexico. Tell us a little bit more about what happens in the book.
Well, first, I would just like to say that I don't think most people that live in this area have any kind of clear understanding of how much narcotics come across the border just on a constant basis.
Right.
And it's thousands of pounds probably a day.
Really?
So as I neared the end of my career, I decided that I would like to try to write a book and, you know, kind of paint a picture of what it was like to work in the war on drugs, which unfortunately we're losing. But, you know, there's just a lot of stories that I accumulated over the course of my career, and I wanted people to understand, number one, the amount of drugs coming across, and then what it was like to be involved in the war on drugs, and, you know, tell some of those stories, explain how difficult it is on family life, and, you know, what it requires of somebody. So in my two books, I basically took a fictitious character, Jimmy Maxwell, and I put him in a fictional case that runs 4 or 5 months. But during the middle of that case, it's interspersed with a lot of little sub-stories of cases that I worked on, you know, where I changed some of the names and details to cover that up. But for the most part, the little sub-stories are true. The overarching story, not so much.
So you got a chance to both tell the small stories of what really goes on and give a message about this is what's happening in San Diego.
Yes. And in the first novel, I went into some of the politics involved, which were very frustrating to most of us that were involved in this kind of work. Not so much in an ongoing investigation. I basically made that more focused on Jimmy and his personal relationships and, you know, what it was like to be the target of somebody who was out there trying to get him.
Now, for how many years did you do this work?
About 23.
A wealth of experience.
Yes.
And you're retired now.
I retired at the end of 2009.
Okay. So your protagonist, Jimmy Maxwell, is he you or is he a combination of several people, fully made up?
He's partially me. I mean, I would like to say that I had his work ethic, and I certainly was as busy as he is in the book during the course of my career. I went through some of those same personal struggles that he goes through. But on the other hand, several of my agents that I used to work with have told me that I'm actually more Tom, his supervisor, the grumpy old guy who, you know, is having to approve everybody's reports and, you know, be that buffer between upper management and the guys working on the street. So, yeah, anyway, a little me. I will say that, Jimmy, my main character, is a bourbon drinker, and I'm right there with him.
And you're a bourbon drinker, okay. I know you worked for Operation Alliance, which was the San Diego division of the DEA, and in marine smuggling investigations. And it sounds terrible and exciting and important. Do you miss the excitement? Do you relive your work when you're writing, or...
There's some of that. Operation Alliance is I spent 16 years of my almost 23 there, and that's mostly customs agents or now ICE agents, and then there's three or four DEA groups, and then there's a half a dozen local cops and a couple of other. I think we had an ATF agent and we had a couple of Border Patrol guys, you know, and it was family. It was like family to me to a large degree.
Could you explain Operation Alliance?
It was a task force of a bunch of different agencies that was formed to work smuggling cases in San Diego, so narcotic smuggling cases. And they respond both to the ports of entry, to seizures made by Customs and Border Protection, the uniformed guys. Also, they did proactive work. Some of it stemmed from follow-ups to port cases. Some was just developed through informants. Some was tips through other law enforcement contacts, San Diego Police Department's narcotics teams. So we worked kind of a wide variety of drug cases.
And you were a team, so when you work on the book, you're sort of making that team continue, would you say? Is that it?
Well, I'm trying to let the readers know what it was like to be part of the team.
A window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you said about the influence of family, how difficult it is on family. In your books, the love interest, Margie Gray, she worries about Jimmy Maxwell's safety and about other things. Now, with the safety of law enforcement in the news so much lately, is there anything you'd like to say about that? Was safety a big stressor on you and your family the way it is for your protagonist?
Not nearly as much, probably, as is portrayed in the book. Certainly, you know, we had our moments. I've been involved in search warrants where there were shootings and different things like that, and I was actually moved out of town for a couple of months with a handful of other agents after some threats came in against us. But for the most part, I didn't really spend a whole lot of time even thinking about that. The tougher part of the work is just being on call all the time. And,
right.
And sometimes you head out in the morning and you think you're coming home at 5, but you may not come home for several days.
Really?
You know, because you just don't know where the case is going to take you. But as for safety, local police have a far riskier job than we did as federal agents.
I see.
Because they're dealing with people that they really don't know. They respond to a radio call or pull somebody over for a traffic ticket, and you don't know if it's some guy on the 10 most wanted list or somebody that just hacked his wife up. Whereas normally we knew who we were targeting. So we took the appropriate amount of people with us to deal with that.
Could you tell us briefly one of the little stories in your book? Could you share with the listeners?
Well, one of the funny little stories involved an older lady who was in her late 70s, a white lady, and she came across the border one Friday night, And there was about 28 or 29 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of her car. And so I was interviewing her, and she just said, look, I went down with some friends of mine who live out here in El Cajon, and I had dinner, and I was getting tired, and they just said, take my car and go home. So I gave her a notice to appear. I tended to believe her. She told me who they were, and the registration on the car matched. Uh-huh. So on Monday morning, I took another agent friend and an El Cajon police detective, and we went and knocked on the door of this couple. Mm-hmm. The man who opened the door was wearing a pair of leopard skin bikini briefs. His legs were about 3 inches in diameter, you know, and he had a little belly and almost bald, had probably 3 chest hairs. And then he invites us in, and, you know, we tell him why we're there, and his wife comes out, and she sits in front of us and does the Sharon Stone leg cross thing. And so I decide that, I would like to take a look around the house because he's denying everything. Uh-huh. Well, as we are looking around the house, there's a lot of adult-themed things, toys, right, and gadgets. Uh-huh. And at one point, I went over to a closet and opened the door, and for about a half a second, I see this body falling out on me, and I actually pulled my gun. It startled me it was dark. Uh-huh. But it turned out it was a blow-up doll.
So,
of course, my partners were all teasing me that, if I would have shot it, it would have went zipping around the room like a, balloon that got popped or something.
Okay. So you never know if something's going to be dangerous, serious, or a little bit
light. Or a little humorous.
Yeah, a little humorous. One last question, Tim. Tell us what's next in your sequel. I understand that you're writing sequel. When should we expect to see that?
Well, I haven't really decided whether or not I'm going to do another one. I'm leaning heavily towards it. Uh-huh. An ongoing investigation kind of ends just before 9/11. So I'm thinking of trying to write a story that will incorporate a little bit of that into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't worked out all the details yet. Both of these other books that I've written took about a year each. If I can get started in the next couple of months, obviously it would be about a year from now before it would come out.
Well, we look forward to seeing it.
Well, I look forward to doing something productive with in my retired years here. So.
And Tim, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Timothy Daniels and his work, please visit his publisher's website at sbpra.com/Timothy Daniels. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon.
Today, I have two very special guests, Mr. Sanati and his daughter, Saviora. He has worked for many years with the International Rescue Assistance Committee, and now he has founded an organization called War Victim Group to help the many minorities who have been displaced from Iraq. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Sanati, can you start out by telling us, since ISIS overran much of Iraq, how many refugees are now displaced from the region?
I believe that there is almost 400,000 refugees. They flee their home from Mosul, from the central of Iraq, and they flee to the north of Iraq, to the Kurdistan, to find a safe place to live in until we find some solution for them.
And what are the conditions like right now that the refugees are living under, from what you're hearing?
Actually, it's the worst for the last century. It's the worst situation that they live in. And they live on the street with no food, with no shelter, with no help from nobody.
It's so tragic. The scale is almost unimaginable. And Saviora, as a young woman, what are you hearing about what's happening with the girls your age that are over there trapped in this region right now?
Many of them are being kidnapped from their homes, sold as slaves for many purposes. Others are being raped and killed in front of their families. It's just some of the most terrible things you can ever think of.
Yeah, heart-wrenching. I know we're seeing in other media that ISIS actually has a manual out about slavery justifying enslaving very, very young girls. It's just heartbreaking. What are the efforts that your organization is doing? What are the goals you have for helping these refugees right now?
You know, we've been working with the Department of State for the last 2 years to find some solution for those refugees. And then when ISIS take over, the situations became more worse. So what we're trying to do to establish a program, it's called private sector. And this private sector, we have to approve it. Our government from, you know, State Department, and we are working on it. We are on daily basis in touch with the department, with all those agencies that work with the refugees, like IRC, like Catholic Charity, and some other, you know, organization. So we've been doing our job until we find some solution for the refugees.
Do you think ultimately the solution is making it safe for them to return to Iraq, if that's even possible, or is it finding them homes, safe havens in other parts of the world?
I believe that through our contact from inside Iraq, 80% of them, the refugee, they want to flee. They want to leave.
Yeah.
20% to have getting benefit from the regional government of Kurdistan, they try to stay there. And what we're trying to do, to help as much as we can, as much as we provide for them, either who's going to stay inside Iraq to live with on the Kurdish territory, or the people that they want to flee. And we are trying to put the pressure on our politician to get this going through. If we approve our program, the private sector, that we're going to find a safe place for these refugees and find them a solution, you know, a permanently solution.
Now, you've mentioned that this is predominantly the Iraqi Christians who have been displaced, but also Jews and some other minorities.
You have to go to the history, because Iraq, it's belong to the native group of native, which is the Chaldean, the Jew, the Assyrian, the Mandai, and the Yazidi. All those people, they've been targeted to flee the country from both sides. From the central government and either from the Kurd. It's politicians play a dirty game, and they try to sweep their history, and they try to come out. We don't know what they are planning for.
So now your organization has filed a lawsuit in international court through the United Nations. Tell us about that.
I believe that when the Americans take over with the allies, and they get rid of the most brutal dictatorship, which is Saddam Hussein, and they set a constitution. And the constitution say that there is every person that got hurt from 1968 to 2003, they have to reimburse all their losses. plus that we are fighting for our share from the oil revenue and all the, you know, benefit from the countries.
Oil revenues. So you're going after the oil revenues. How much money is at stake there?
You know, Iraq, it's the richest country in the world. And our politicians, they make mistake when they bring to the power a group of thieves and group of gangs to control all that revenue.
The new government that the U.S. coalition put in place after the 10-12-year war over there.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. By the constitution, that every single person in Iraq have right, have share of this, you know, oil revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And we are part of that country. We are the native of that country. We are the root of that country. The Chaldean, the Jew, the Assyrian, and the Yazidi and the Mandai, they are the root of the country. So we have to have a share. And I believe that there is 5 or 6% is belong to those native. And we are fighting for this, for their right.
So 6% of the oil
revenue. Of the oil revenue.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back how far, to what year?
Since 2003 till now and continuing to the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is our right. I believe that if there is a constitution that he protect all the people, we are part of those people. And we need our government to engage directly to get our tribe back.
How long could it take for this to work its way through the courts with the United Nations?
We submit our claim. This is almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking to Department of State for the last 2 years, couple times or three times. We met with them, and we explained everything to them. And they asked us to put everything together. And there is thousands and thousands of people. They allowed me to represent them and to fight for them. So our organization right now, we are fighting for just not the oil revenue. We are fighting for their freedom, for their right to live in peace and stop this genocide against our people, our the native of Iraqi people,
yeah,
whether from ISIS or from some other politician.
So to protect religious freedom and restore,
exactly,
religious freedom in Iraq,
yeah,
which is the cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia.
Exactly.
You've had meetings back in Washington, I understand, with the State Department. How did that go?
They are working with us very closely. But what we try to do now, it's the most important thing to us, to our organization right now, of to find a safe place for the people that have been kicked out from their home. This is in the top of our agenda right now. The claim, I know that's going to take more time, you know, because, you know, we have to bring the government of Iraq to the table to negotiate what we're asking for.
Yeah.
But the main issue right now is the situation for the refugees.
You're a refugee yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened, your situation, and what made you flee Iraq and come to America?
I believe it's history. It's repeated himself. In 1975, Saddam Hussein, he destroyed 225 villages from our native people on the north of Kurdistan, accusing them that they are helping the ruffle of the Kurd. By that time, I used to work. I was on early age, you know, and I was ambitious. And I write an article, and I ask, where's the human right? Then I became target for the Iraqi government. So I have to flee, or I lose my life.
Yeah.
So I decide to flee, and I became a refugee to the United States.
And for your daughter, do you hope to be able to go back to Iraq someday?
I mean, that's the dream for a lot of American-born Iraqi kids, but is it going to be able to be obtained? We're not sure.
Yeah.
It's not safe right now, so who knows?
I understand you tried to take a trip to the Middle East, and the timing was bad. What happened?
In 2008, we were there on a humanitarian mission. We were working closely with a lot of the Iraqi refugees who had fled the war to Syria, and we were in Syria, and we were, you know, with my brother, my sister, and myself, and we thought about crossing the border. As we got towards the border, we noticed that it was just overtaken by militants, and we decided, you know, it's too risky.
And that was the start of the Syrian Revolution when you were?
About 3 months, 3 to 4 months after we left the country, that's when the Syrian Revolution broke out.
Yeah. What can listeners do to help if people who are hearing this program want to reach out, do something to help these refugees? Mr. Sanati, where can they get more information and what can they do?
My idea, we are targeting the American people, not the Chaldean people or the minority of Iraq, because we try to let the American what's going on over there and what's happening and how the genocide against... We are on the beginning of 21st century and still the women is being sold as a slave with $100 in Mosul. It's a crime. It's a shame on the face of the history. Slave is going back to the country that he put the world, the first step of civilization. Iraq, it's the country that it's a prophet countries. All the prophet, they became from that part of the world. So what we're trying to do to let the American to work with us and to put the pressure on our politician to change their view and to find some solution to stop this genocide against our people.
What do you believe the best solution is? If you could wave a magic wand, if you were the president today, what would you do?
First step is to find safe place for those people. Then we will find a solution for this problem for all, for good.
Now, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Pope's order responding to the local Chaldean church at El Cajon, sparing Father Noel and other priests in the United States from having to go back to Iraq.
We know certainly that the situation in Iraq is extremely dangerous for people of faith, that priests have been killed, churches burned, destroyed, priests beheaded even over there. And yet the Chaldean church leadership had ordered several priests from the United States back to Iraq, including Father Noel from El Cajon, and there was an appeal to Pope Francis.
The problem, it's politic. Nothing have to do with religious. And I believe that our Patriarch, he make a big mistake. It wasn't the time to call those priests to go back, because people, I received so many calls from inside Iraq, from so many priests that they flee their homeland, their home in Mosul and some other part of Iraq, to find a safe place for them. So how he tried to call those priests to go back? Can he protect them? He cannot protect himself. So how we can protect those priests? And usually those priests, they are American citizens. They're going to be targeted for kidnap and, you know, killed.
Yeah.
But I believe the Pope, he's so smart. He stopped the order right now. He frees it. You know, they are doing their job. They are serving their community. And we are behind them 200%.
So the Pope has overturned that order, and now Father Noel and the other priests are safe.
Yes.
Well, that's good news for many folks right here in East County. If people want to learn more about the war victim group, where can they get additional information?
You know, we have our office. There is thousands of people. They file with us. Mm-hmm. And we still, the door, it's open for all the minority that they can join us on our claim.
Mm-hmm.
This is their right. We are fighting for their right, for their dignity, for their history.
And the claim, we should mention, the legal claim has been filed, I understand, against the governments of Iraq as well as Kurdistan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The claim, it's in two parts. One of against the central government of Iraq, and 80% is against the regional government of Kurdistan. Because, you know, mostly all our villages, it's on that part. It's on the north of Iraq. If you go back to the history that 7,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, we used to be on the south. Then because of those war, because we've been targeted for the last 1,400 years. And now it's come to the point that they try to kick us out for good. But we're not going to let that happen. We will fight until last moment to get everybody his right.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for joining us today. And if people want more information, is there a phone number or an address you'd like us to give them?
Yes, they can contact us at 749-9464 or 749-9472.
Well, thank you so very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, on this very, very important issue.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Ed Bereno with the Business Report from East County Magazine.
Over 24 Albertsons and Vons grocery stores in our region are being sold to Hagen Food and Pharmacy, a small grocery chain headquartered in Washington State that is focused on healthy, natural, and gourmet foods. It's all part of a 146-store acquisition by Hagen, which currently owns just 18 stores. The $400 million purchase is an 811% expansion for Hagen, and it is expected to close early this year. The majority of Hagen shares are owned by Comvest Partners, a private equity firm. The Federal Trade Commission, as part of approving a Safeway Albertsons merger, is requiring the two large chains to divest the stores that are now being sold. Safeway currently owns Vons along with other brands. Hagen's CEO, Bill Shaner, has described the Hagen Food and Pharmacy chain as somewhere between a Vons and a Whole Foods. For the past 80 years, Hagen has sourced a substantial amount of its food from local farmers, ranchers, and fisheries in its northwest location. The store also carries artisan cheeses, locally brewed beers, local wines, breads made from scratch, organic foods, natural health products, fair trade items, and pharmacy products. A key unknown is what the impact will be on pricing for consumers. Hagen's 146 new stores are located in Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, and Arizona. The company plans to spend the first half of this year converting them to the Hagen banner. Employees at the purchased stores will be given the option to stay, and any existing union contracts will be honored, Shaner said. The stores being acquired by Hagen include several in East County and 25 in the San Diego region overall. East County locations include 4 Vaughn stores, 2 in La Mesa on Lake Murray Boulevard and on Avocado, as well as 2 in El Cajon on Fletcher Parkway and Camino Canada. Hagen is also acquiring 2 Albertsons stores in East County, in El Cajon on Broadway and in Santee on Magnolia. Several other large natural foods-oriented grocery stores have recently moved into East County. Sprouts Farmers Market, owned by mega chain Wild Oats, acquired Henry's Markets in Lemon Grove, La Mesa, El Cajon, and Santee. Trader Joe's has a brisk business in La Mesa, and most recently, Barron's Market opened up shop in Alpine, indications that the market in East County may be ripe for a broader market entry by a supermarket chain dedicated to healthy offerings.
This is Miriam Raftery with some important news for pet owners. San Diego-based Petco, the nation's largest pet product retailer, announced that it has removed all dog treats and cat treats made in China from its store shelves nationwide as well as off its website. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has been investigating over 5,600 complaints of illnesses and deaths of pets that ate the Chinese-made jerky and rawhide treats, including chicken, duck, and sweet potato varieties. Nearly all of the illnesses occurred in dogs, so a handful have been reported in cats and even humans who consumed or handled contaminated products. Pets that ate these products suffered symptoms ranging from vomiting and internal bleeding to kidney failure. There have been numerous warnings issued on multiple brands linked to illnesses from Chinese products, yet the problem has persisted and the FDA has been unable to determine the specific cause. Petco announced last May that it planned to remove the treats but took months to complete a change of vendors for all of its 1,300 stores as well as its online sales.
In addition to treats, Petco had previously banned all dog foods and cat foods made in China.
Petco's main rival, PetSmart, has announced that it will also stop carrying Chinese-made treats but has not yet set a specific date for removal of all Chinese products.
It's a chance in a million. A dog named Chance, missing for the past 8 years, has been reunited with his family in El Cajon. Back in 2006, the Tatar family came home to find their dog had been apparently stolen from his outdoor kennel. They posted flyers around their El Cajon neighborhood and checked local shelters, but there was no trace of their missing boxer, who was then 4 years old. Then on December 29, 2014, the County Department of Animal Services picked up a dog that had wandered onto a property in Bonsall and took him to a county shelter in Carlsbad. The boxer was scanned for a microchip and it turned out to be Chance. Dan D'Souza, Deputy Director of the County's Animal Services Department, says the Tatar family members were astounded and ecstatic when they got the telephone call saying that Chance had been found. Lila Tatar, who was 10 years old when Chance went missing, is now 18 and delighted to have her long-lost dog returned. Fortunately, Chance was microchipped by the family's vet. Since Chance went missing in 2006, the family has taken in 6 dogs, all of them microchipped. Lila Tatar urges everyone to have their pets microchipped, reminding pet owners, you never know, something like what happened with Chance could happen to you. Is settling into his home, the same one he lived in 8 years ago. He lost weight while missing, and the family is working to help him regain it, but otherwise he's healthy and doing very well. Leela says he definitely remembered us. As soon as he got home, he walked around and started wagging his tail and responding to his name. D'Souza said employees in the department are always happy to see a pet reunited with its owner, but it was especially touching to see this particular reunification between a family and its beloved pet after such a long absence, 8 years. Chance's microchip is credited for giving him and his family another shot at life together. D'Souza points out a collar with an identification tag can easily be removed, but that microchip is proof positive as to who that animal is and who that animal belongs to. Animal Services offers low-cost microchipping every Thursday at county animal shelters from 1 to 3 p.m. for dogs, cats, and rabbits. The service is also available through veterinarians, and for owners of pets like Chance, the effort can pay off with peace of mind that lost pets can be found, even if they are found far from home many years after they go missing. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
If you went to Parkway Plaza Shopping Mall in El Cajon on December 29th, you may have been exposed to measles. The County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency warns that two San Diego siblings who visited the mall were recently diagnosed with measles. They are among seven people believed to have contracted measles while visiting Disneyland between December 15th and 20th. Locally, those most at risk are shoppers and employees who were present at the Parkway Plaza Mall on December 29th between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., especially if you were around GameStop, Sunglasses Hut, and the Carousel. There is no risk to shoppers who visited on other dates. Those who were at Parkway Plaza Mall on December 29th should watch for symptoms, and if you develop any sign of measles, contact your doctor by telephone. Measles is a highly contagious disease, spread easily by coughing, sneezing, or direct contact with an infected person. The disease takes 21 days, that's 3 weeks, to develop. Early symptoms include cough, runny nose, and red eyes. A distinctive red rash usually appears 1 to 4 days after the early symptoms, but the patient is contagious starting 4 days before the rash appears. The rash starts on the face and head, then proceeds downward and outward to the hands and feet, and it fades in the same order it began, from head to foot. The county's top health officer, Dr. Wilma Wooten, says measles is spread through the air and is very infectious to persons who are not vaccinated, including infants under age 12 months who are too young to receive the first dose. The best way to prevent measles, she says, is by getting the measles vaccine. Now, everybody born in 1957 or after should have documentation of at least one dose of MMR, that's measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends two doses of the vaccine, first at 12 months and the second between ages 4 and 6 years old. Complications of measles are more common in children younger than 5 years old and adults over 20. Complications can include diarrhea, ear infections, and pneumonia. Death can occur from severe complications, and the risk is higher among young children and adults. There is no treatment for measles. Bed rest, fluids, and fever control are recommended, and people with complications may need treatment for those specific problems. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
With the arrival of a new year, people make ambitious resolutions, and many of them, including my own, seem to focus on getting fit, losing weight, or just living a more active lifestyle. According to the website Statistic Brain, losing weight was the number one resolution made on January 1st last year. 62% of Americans make a resolution at least occasionally, but according to Forbes, only 8% of people achieve their New Year's resolutions. If you want to improve your odds of success, the County of San Diego has hundreds of activities throughout the year at a variety of skill and interest levels. Many of them are free or low cost, and they take place in locations all over the county. The San Diego County Library has over 350 health and fitness events in January alone. The library has an online calendar of events that list all of them, searchable by location, date, and age group. Yoga, dance classes, Zumba, nutrition and cooking classes, meditation, and martial arts are just a few of the types of offerings at the library. All library events are completely free. San Diego County Parks and Recreation Department also has a wide range of activities for all ages. Hiking, sports leagues, equestrian opportunities, dance classes, yoga, and fitness boot camps are all offered at various county parks or community centers. The online parks activity guides list all the locations, times, and costs, if any, for all events. One of the most popular activities in the parks is hiking. There are miles of hiking, biking, or equestrian trails on the county's 30 parks and open space preserves. There are simple strolls along quiet streams for a leisurely hike, while experienced hikers looking for a challenge can hike rugged mountains and isolated valleys. San Diego County has one of the most diverse trail systems in the nation. Most of our trails are multi-use and have been designed to accommodate hikers, bikers, and horse riders. For more information, you can visit the parks website at sandiegocounty.gov/parks. This has been Ed Barrena with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barrena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.